KXSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
Let's start off with some Pride news. Mm-hmm. Sebastian, what would you expect? Because, of course, all summer there'll be Prides happening all over the world and all over Canada.
Yep.
And first of all, Sebastian, what would you expect to see at Letterkenny Pride?
Pupper's brand beer, which started off as fictional, and then somebody actually started a brewery called Pupper's. There's also a gin or vodka. I can't remember. There was a company that started a liquor that started off as fictional in the show Letterkenny, and then somebody made it real. I would imagine a pride dance at the either the Ukrainian Center or the Ag Hall. And I would expect the actor who plays Squirrely Dan to show up and do something. That would be my guesses. Obviously, I'm a big fan of the show Letterkenny, even though I know very little about Taylor Swift.
Well, I'm afraid to disappoint you. You're kind of 0 for 0 for all of them. What you can expect is a drag brunch at the Orchard.
Okay.
There is a flag raising. There'll be an unmissable bingo event, apparently. There is a beginner's hair and makeup. And it's all, of course, taking place in Ireland, in County Donegal, where Letterkenny is literally located.
Original Letterkenny, not Canadian Letterkenny.
Yeah. The actual Irish Letterkenny, not the Southern Ontario fictional Letterkenny. Is Letterkenny a real place in Ontario?
It's northwestern. It's near Goderich.
Oh, okay. Wow.
It's near the part of Ontario that gets tornado problems.
Well, that's increasingly more and more of Ontario. Now, speaking of tornado problems, there's no great segue here, but what Pride news have you been picking up on over the last little while?
Oh, the big ones are Halifax and Montreal. Actually Cornwall as well, but that's a sort of a lesser story. The Cornwall story is more about what it represents than actually what happened. But do you have a preference about where we start?
Well, let's start off with Halifax. We mentioned Halifax Pride, Halifax, Nova Scotia, just last week. Mm-hmm. And we had mentioned that during the Pride event, it was disrupted by protesters who were advocating a swift end to the war in Palestine. That's where the war is taking place. The protests held up the parade for, I think, about 20 odd minutes. But the story that has emerged after the fact actually relates to the Premier of Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. Now, the Premier of Nova Scotia, Tim Houston, says that he decided not to attend the Pride Parade on the advice of the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Mm-hmm. Now, the RCMP have clarified publicly to the CBC that where they did advise the Premier's office of the security risks, they did inform the Premier that they would, of course, provide appropriate security should he choose to attend. And that ultimately the choice of whether or not to attend was the Premier's own. It's worth noting that the Premier's office did say that the Conservative Premier, Tim Houston, has marched in 2021, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
The following one was cancelled due to the pandemic.
Right, yeah.
So this has been really one of the first Pride events to happen since the pandemic in Halifax, and the Premier chose not to attend. Now, I'm on the fence about this. You know, on the one hand, my gut instinct is, what is so unsafe for the premier that mm-hmm. he feels that every other Joe Schmo walking around Halifax that day is not at risk. Like how risky is it? And should the rest of us be somewhat aware of that? But I think that that's not quite the case. You made a great point earlier when we were getting ready for the show about mm-hmm. how that 20-minute disruption, which did end up happening,
yeah,
would have left them sitting there for 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's worth noting as well that Halifax Pride did notify the participants in the Pride Parade that they were effectively expecting protests because yeah. they had happened at nearly every other, not every other Pride, but a significant number of them. Mm-hmm. Sebastian, what's your take on this? What have I missed?
I mean, you did miss the assaults that happened on that couple about a month ago, the two women in Halifax who were surrounded yes, and beaten yeah, up we... by like a dozen men. So there seems to be violence against the community in Halifax. I mean, there's violence against the community across the country, but in Halifax, it is a major story that is still unresolved. And it's violence between strangers as well, which is exceptionally rare, especially on that scale of like a dozen men beating up two women. So I could understand that there's sort of an atmosphere in Halifax of people feeling unsafe and people feeling unsafe around Pride in specific as a thing. Now, the community banding together in that historical atmosphere of protest and saying, safe or unsafe, we're going to march, which is how it was in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and part of the 90s. It was just, we are marching because it is unsafe. And mm-hmm. I can understand that, but for a politician to come out there who is not necessarily a member of the community, and they're being recommended by officials, you know, officials in the realm of security, you are particularly at risk of safety concerns. It's the difference between like the masses are unsafe versus you as an individual are unsafe. Like something could happen to someone at Pride versus you as a representative could be especially targeted, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. So there is that general atmosphere. Halifax is going through kind of a period right now. And there is concerns about escalating violence against political representatives over the past, well, since the incident. So it's, yeah, I mean, my initial instinct was very much like yours, like, calm down. It's Canada. It's Halifax. Don't worry about it. And then I actually started thinking about it. And I was like, this is just gray area enough where if Tim Houston said, never mind, I'm going to march, or never mind, I'm going to stay at home, either way can be motivated. It makes sense either way.
So one of the things that I kind of want your thoughts on here. So the NDP leader, Claudia Chender, spoke to the CBC on this. And frankly, just isn't buying it. Just isn't okay. buying it.
Okay, yeah.
No, it's not. Essentially, it's not a case of the RCMP warned the premier about attending. Mm-hmm. That wasn't it. According to the article here on the CBC, the premier's office asked the RCMP about security. Now, mm-hmm. it's worth mentioning that every other political party yeah. did attend.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I believe that the leaders of every other political party did mm-hmm. attend. So why is it too risky for the Conservatives but not too risky for other political leaders in the province?
Well,
it's worth noting that the other political leaders are not the elected premier.
They're so not holding the seat.
Yeah. They're not holding the office.
Yeah,
but the
yeah.
thing I wanted to pose to you, Sebastian, is mm-hmm. really a question here of allyship.
Yeah,
I think it is certainly easier to be an ally towards a community, in this case, the 2S LGBTQ plus community, mm-hmm. when it isn't a popular opinion to hold. It is
yes.
easy to be an ally when everyone around you is an ally.
Yeah.
The tide is shifting a little bit, especially in conservative circles, more towards a more hostile approach towards the 2S LGBTQ community. And therefore, potentially being an ally now is not as easy as it was 2, 3, 4 years ago, when the political climate was more forgiving. What do you think, Sebastian? Do you think that that perhaps that question needs to be posed? Is it inconvenient or less easy to be a visible ally now than it was a few years ago?
Well, if you're specifically talking about the Conservatives, I think that's a separate question. But if you're talking about like performative allyship, it is absolutely easier now, because now all you have to do is fill out the paperwork and show up. Whereas 20 years ago, you had to go out of your way. It was a much bigger deal. It was a lot more serious. I think Jack Layton was the first top level, federal level, major political representative to march in Pride. And it was a very big deal at the time. I mean, there may have been somebody before him, but if you're talking about high profile people, like the kind of person who, you know, somebody in Yellowknife would have heard about them marching in Toronto. I believe it was Jack Layton. And I do remember they made a very big deal out of that. But these days, all you need to do is fill out the paperwork and show up. As for the Conservatives, I don't know about hostility against the 2SLGBTQ movement as a whole. I don't think that's at all fair or accurate. There have been internal memos that have been leaked from the federal level Conservative Party that basically said, drop gay marriage, leave it alone. It is not going to be a party platform anymore. Ignore it. It's not widely reported, but Pierre Poilievre, his father is married to another man. Pierre is very indifferent about a lot of the same-sex issues. If you're to say that the Conservative Party is specifically wrestling with trans issues, then I would be like 100% on board with that. But lumping everything together as 2SLGBTQ is kind of, I don't know, it's they're differentiating. You could say, we don't want to differentiate, we don't want to split up the community, we don't want to do LGB versus TQ+, but that's the language that they're using. So even if you personally don't want to split it up, if you're talking about from a political perspective, there are people who are dividing the two. The LGB is a non-issue now. It's the TQ+ where you're seeing pushback from the Conservative Party. So that does mean that from the political activism perspective, the Conservative Party is pushing back against the political activist angle, especially the TQ+. But if you're talking about civil liberties and human rights, it's a little bit more mixed bag. You got to get a little bit more specific. Overall, I would say against the Pride movement, Pride festivals, the kind of things that are represented there, they're not on the same page. Absolutely, that's fair. But to say that they're hostile against all 2SLGBTQ people, I think that is brushing over a distinction that they are making. You could say that we don't want to make that distinction, and that's fair. I mean, that's a very reasonable thing to do, but they're making that distinction. And there are a lot of notes going around basically saying, for same-sex issues, you know, the blood ban, marriage rights, all that kind of thing, just leave it alone, drop it. That's not a party platform anymore. Same thing is actually happening in the States and in the UK as well. There's a lot of places that are starting to say, I think I heard about that, but I'm not sure about that. I think Australia also has like 2 or 3 major Conservative parties as well. I don't think they have a single point for that. But definitely in Canada, the UK and the States, there are internal memos going around saying for some of this stuff, like we at the federal level, we don't care anymore. Just drop it. But trans issues, for sure. For sure, 100%. Yeah. So it's, I don't know. And to say, if you're not on board with the message, maybe you shouldn't attend Pride. Yeah, fair enough. Absolutely. But then that brings us on to Cornwall Pride. And in Cornwall, the local Conservative representatives were told to not attend. And the story is what it is. It's kind of predictable. You're not on message. We don't support you because you don't support us. That's fair. But then it does bring up a conversation of, the local representative for Cornwall, they weren't speaking out against anything. They were just abstaining from votes. They were dragging their heels. They weren't commenting on things. They weren't really participating in the discussion about trans health rights. And a few other people were saying, but the Liberals weren't banned when they were dragging their heels on the blood ban. So is this really an anti-conservative movement, or is this punishing politicians for not being, well, not maybe not punishing, but uninviting politicians for not being on brand and for only showing up for cheap optics? And I think that's, if you're going to say, if you're dragging your heels on something, you're not welcome, then yeah, fair enough, across the board, let's go for it. I mean, you and I, we were pretty openly disappointed with the Liberals for years on this show for dragging
their critical
heels. Yeah.
Week after week.
Yeah,
and it was the case. They still have a lot of things to do better at.
We had many guests coming on agreeing with. I mean, obviously, we didn't even cherry pick as well. We just got people to say, like, can you think of a reason? And Gary Lacasse, head of the HIV AIDS Canada, basically said, like, no reason. There's no reason. Any reason you could think of was no longer true as of 2007. So it was, yeah, it's weird. The whole thing is weird.
Well, the role that the trans community plays is ever-growing.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing representation increase, and not because suddenly today there are more trans people. Mm-hmm. It's more people have access to the language and so on and so forth. For example, we're keeping an eye on Quinn on the Canadian Olympic soccer team as they go through there. Well, we will discuss the Olympics just after our first song break of the day. Now, you suggested that we go with A Cause de Garçon by Yael.
Yeah.
Well, I'd suggested kicking off with Celine Dion because, you know, gay, as in me, not Celine Dion.
Yes.
But why did you choose Yael instead?
It's just an insider thing. If you know French culture, Yael is like the, I guess she's kind of an analog to Lady Gaga. Like, she's incredibly popular with the gay community in France. And I chose A Cause de Garçon because it's not crass. She has other songs where she is a woman who loves men, let's say. And A Cause de Garçon literally translates to because of the boys. So it is it's a song. Also, it's a banger. It's a good club hit. So, yeah.
And we'll be back just after this.
Yeah.
And welcome back to Canqui, home of Canada's queer medium. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
So I wanted to talk about the Olympics. According to Outsports, which I believe are the ones that are most Johnny on the spot about chasing down all these details, we have emailed the Canadian Olympic Committee asking for a list of the openly LGBTQ-identified artists, openly LGBTQ-identified sports people participating.
Athletes.
That's the word I was looking for. I was like, what's the word I'm missing here? The sportsing people to do, because sometimes it's nice to just cheer on success and amplify that success. We are thrilled with any Canadian that won. I will be watching the synchronized diving just after we finish recording this to watch the bronze medal win by the Canadian duo there. Very excited about that. But yeah, we'll be keeping an eye on it. But in Canada, we are specifically looking at golf. Alina Sharp, Olivia Apps in the rugby, along with Sophie DuJour and Mary Grant. I mentioned Quinn earlier, also Kayleen Sheridan and Kadisha Buchanan there for the soccer. And I think Crystal in track and field, and Justin Louis in the volleyball, and Emma Wright in the water polo. So we are watching all of those sports, which is a lot of sports for us. I have to say, it's more sports than.
Yes, I overheard a discussion between you and your partner yesterday where you're like, you have no idea what's going on in water polo. It confuses you, but you just enjoy watching it.
Yeah. And then you told me it was like a game of basketball in the water. Yeah. And it amazed me that, because they were wrestling, and I was like, someone's going to drown. Like, this is like, oh my gosh, water polo, I could never. It's a health hazard, surely, to be grappling and treading water at the same time.
I actually went to school with somebody who was in a water polo team, and he was Olympic ready, but he decided to focus on his master's instead. And he went through amazing body manipulation in the process. They gain and lose weight throughout the year. Like, they put on body fat because you float more. You actually have a huge advantage by being that sort of like padded, like dad bod muscle fat kind of a body because you float more. But then you're a faster swimmer if you're more lean. So they gain and lose weight throughout the year according to whether they're training or whether they're competing. And he had three separate wardrobes. Like, it was really fascinating seeing these people play. And it's the opposite of what you would normally expect, because most people are just one weight the whole year. I don't know. Athletes, they go through some crazy stuff.
I grew up in Britain, and the role that Tom Daley plays in the British culture, the sort of the zeitgeist of Britain popular culture, just won silver in the men's synchronized diving, clipped ahead of the Canadians there, behind the Chinese. But yeah, it's just the fact that he was openly out, and it's just, there's this huge queer sort of history narrative that happens there. But I wanted to mention that there was a wonderful article. I'm just trying to find where it was. I think it was pinknews.co.uk, and they looked at the full history of queerness in the Olympics, because of course, you know, if we go all the way back to ancient Greece, you get a whole bunch of literally oily men running around, certain appetites get built up, and it was frequently depicted in different places that things may have occurred. So it's not like the Olympics has been, alien to queer culture. But what's really interesting is the first publicly gay Olympic athlete. Do you want to guess when that was? Sort of on record, publicly out.
The 60s?
Very good guess. You would not have guessed that it was the Comte de Montsquieu-Fazenac in 1893.
Your French is embarrassing.
Thank you. I have been practicing.
Was it a comte or a vicomte? Because they still had vicomtes around at the time.
I believe it was the comte.
Okay.
And he won a bronze medal at the Hacks and Hunter combined event. It was the dressage. There have been openly gay people in dressage for just so many. One of the most decorated Olympians apparently was, I think it was the equestrian sports as well. Yeah. Lee Pearson, I think it is, that British Paralympic equestrian, 14 gold medals. Now, it was only in the sort of 60s and 70s and only really in the last few games, we're talking the last 10, 15 years,
yeah,
that openly LGBTQ athletes have been increasing. I believe, I want to say 2020 had, I think, 200 and something gay athletes. There are so far 191, according to Outsports. So yeah, we are keeping an eye on it. But yeah, it's great. I think what that really says fundamentally, because this is a big number and you're like, okay, cool, gay people doing sports, like, that's, why would that be interesting or newsworthy? But when we're talking about 191, that must mean that there are enough countries where being gay and doing the sport is, first of all, permissible, but also an environment where they can then excel to the Olympic level.
Yeah.
You know, to quote Tom Daley, you know, he was saying about how he became a much better athlete once he was out, because you're not expending that brain space thinking about, oh, you know, am I going to be outed? Am I standing too close to somebody or what have you?
Not to state the obvious, but sometimes it does help to say the quiet part out loud, that stereotypically anyway, historically, sports were known as being a very homophobic environment.
Mm-hmm.
Male-dominated and machismo-dominated, to the point where even female athletes felt uncomfortable as female athletes for quite some time. You could see old black-and-white footage from like 100 years ago, some of the early Olympics in the 1920s. There were women there, but they were not made to feel welcome. And it wasn't until much, much later, like when the Olympics really started exploding in the sort of a post-war 50s, 60s, 70s, where it was sort of a symbol of unity. That's when you started to see a lot more female athletes coming out and doing well. And then now you're seeing a lot more openly LGBT athletes coming out and doing well. And that sort of machismo atmosphere of, you know, the British private school, it's good for a young man to get beaten up by older boys in rugby. Like, that whole atmosphere of sport is finally being dropped.
I mean, I think what the Olympics really, really focuses on is the excellence in the sport.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happens that some of the people who are truly excellent in that sport are themselves gay.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I've noticed, some dating apps have a feature that allows you to explore or to sort of drop in on other areas. Now, for the Olympics, I think they've estimated like 300,000 prophylactics or condoms for the Olympic Village and the use of the athletes. And some people have noticed that some of the apps allow you to just drop your location as being in the athlete Olympic Village.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you're surrounded in your app by Olympic level athletes,
mm-hmm.
Except for one. And that is Grindr.
Yep.
You airdrop in on the Olympic Village in Paris, and it is zero people. According to Grindr, there are zero people in the Olympic Village. Now, I strongly agree with this approach by Grindr. This isn't the first time they did it. I think they did it for the first time in 2008 in China. And the reason being is that for many of these athletes, we have talked about the 191 openly LGBTQ athletes.
Mm-hmm.
But it is well known that some athletes in the past have been targeted and outed using gay hookup apps in particular. Yep. So Grindr just washes its hands and says, look, we won't out athletes.
Yep.
I believe that if you're physically in the village and physically on Grindr, you can physically see them. But people can't airdrop in from outside.
It's like an exclusion zone.
Exactly. Yeah. I like that. I think that's a great safety feature.